From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Having my hands tied behind my back to my legs, like an animal, as they call it in America, hog-tied, with a hood placed over my head, so I was in a suffocating position, kicked and beaten and sworn at and spat at, left to rot in this position for hours and hours on end, and taken again into interrogation. And this lasted over a period over a month.
Former Guantanamo prisoner Mozambique. He was imprisoned for 3 years without charge by the United States at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. In a Democracy Now! U.S. national broadcast exclusive, we air his first comments in this country since the publication of his book in Britain, Enemy Combatant, A British Muslim's Journey to Guantanamo and Back. Then, in an historic move, Senator Russ Feingold introduces a resolution to censure President Bush.
When the President of the United States breaks the law, he must be held accountable. That is why today I'm introducing a resolution to censure President George W. Bush.
When we're talking about censure of the President of the United States at a time of war, when this President is out defending the American people with a very good, lawful, constitutional program, it is serious business.
Majority Leader Bill Frist, Senator Russ Feingold, and more. And over 100,000 people march in Chicago to rally against a proposed immigration bill. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Capitol Hill, Wisconsin Democratic Senator Russ Feingold has introduced a resolution to censure President Bush for authorizing the National Security Agency to conduct warrantless domestic surveillance.
The president violated the law, ignored the Constitution and the other two branches of government, and disregarded the rights and freedoms upon which our country was founded.
Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist attempted to force the Senate to immediately vote on Feingold's resolution before anyone actually read it, but Democrats protested the move. However, few Senate Democrats have yet to publicly support Feingold's move to censure. Meanwhile, in the House, the number of Democrats backing a resolution to impeach the president has now topped 30. In news from Europe, Slobodan Milosevic's son is now claiming his father was killed. Milosevic was found dead in his jail cell Saturday in The Hague, where he was on trial for war crimes. Meanwhile, officials at the United Nations War Crimes Tribunal said the late Serb leader may have died after taking unprescribed medication. The trial of Zacharias Moussaoui has been thrown into turmoil after a federal judge delayed the sentencing after it was revealed a government lawyer had violated court rules by improperly coaching government witnesses. Moussaoui has already pled guilty, but now a jury is deciding whether he should be sentenced to death or life in prison. The government no longer argues Moussaoui was meant to be the 20th hijacker, but they claim the September 11th attacks could have been prevented if Moussaoui had told police about the imminent attack when he was arrested August 16, 2001. On Monday, the federal judge, Leonie Brinkema, threatened to end the trial because of the government's mishandling of the case. From the bench, the judge said, quote, "In all the years I've been on the bench, I have never seen such an egregious violation of the court rules on witnesses. This is a second significant error by the government affecting the constitutional rights of this defendant. More importantly, it affects the integrity of the criminal justice system of the United States," she says. In France, student demonstrations are continuing throughout the country to protest a new employment law that'll make it easier for companies to fire young workers. On Monday, hundreds of university students stormed the Collège de France and the Latin Quarter of Paris. Students hurled stones and cans at the police, who responded with tear gas. Nearby, the elite Sorbonne University remains closed. Over the weekend, police raided the school to force out several hundred protesters who had taken over buildings. The Sorbonne was the center of the May 1968 student uprising. Agence France-Presse reports student strikes are taking place at more than 40 universities across France. More street demonstrations are planned for today. A new book by New York Times reporter Michael Gordon has revealed Britain's top envoy in Iraq expressed major concerns about how the U.S. was handling the occupation of Iraq as early as May 2003. 4 days after arriving in Iraq, the envoy, John Sawyers, wrote that the U.S. occupation forces had, quote, no leadership, no strategy, no coordination, no structure, and were inaccessible to ordinary Iraqis. In a series of memos, Sawyers identified multiple U.S. mistakes, including a lack of interest by U.S. Commander General Tommy Franks in the post-invasion phase, the private contractor Bechtel failure to quickly reconnect basic services such as electricity and water, and the decision to sack junior-level members of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party. Meanwhile, on Monday, President Bush vowed for the first time to turn over most of Iraq to newly trained Iraqi troops by the end of this year. It's unclear how this will happen. Just last month, the Pentagon admitted there is no longer any Iraqi battalions capable of fighting without U.S. support. Bush made the announcement during a speech that launched a new public relations campaign to win greater support for the war in Iraq and his presidency. The latest USA Today CNN poll shows the president's approval rating is at just 36%. And 60% of the country says the war in Iraq is going badly. During his same speech, Bush attempted to tie Iran to the war in Iraq by accusing Tehran of helping Shia fighters build improvised devices that have been used against U.S.-led forces and civilians. In other news on Iran, the Washington Post is reporting prominent Iranian activists say President Bush's plan to spend tens of millions of dollars to promote democracy inside Iran is endangering the lives of human rights advocates by tainting them as American agents. Last month, the government in Tehran jailed two Iranians who traveled outside the country to attend what was billed as a series of workshops on human rights. Two others who attended were interrogated for 3 days. Meanwhile, back in Iraq, the bodies of 15 men have been found in an abandoned vehicle in a Sunni area west of Baghdad. This brings the total number of corpses found around the capital over the past day to at least 72. And the country's leading journalist union is asking the government to provide Iraqi journalists with extra security measures. Two Iraqi journalists have been killed over the past week. Here in this country, a former Vietnam War resistor who's been living in Canada since 1968 has been arrested and jailed on desertion charges. The 56-year-old Alan Abney has lived in Canada since he quit the Marines to protest the Vietnam War. He was arrested Thursday at the Vancouver-Idaho border. Last week, USA Today reported the U.S. military has been intensifying its hunt for Vietnam-era war resistors. The paper also reported 8,000 U.S. soldiers have deserted the military since the invasion of Iraq. Former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor warned last week that the United States is in danger of edging towards a dictatorship if right-wingers continue to attack the judiciary. In one of her first public speeches since leaving the bench, O'Connor, who was nominated by Ronald Reagan, sharply criticized Republicans for strong-arming the judiciary. According to a report on NPR, O'Connor said, quote, "It takes a lot of degeneration before a country falls into dictatorship, but we should avoid these ends by avoiding these beginnings." In environmental news, U.S. scientists have determined the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has reached a new record high. The BBC reports the precise level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is of global concern because scientists fear certain thresholds may be tipping points that trigger sudden changes in climate. The chief carbon dioxide analyst for the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says the latest data confirms a worrying trend. The British government's chief scientific advisor, David King, said, quote, "Mankind is changing the climate." Media watch groups are expressing concern over the recent sale of Knight Ridder, the country's second-largest newspaper chain. The smaller newspaper publisher McClatchy Company bought out the 32-paper Knight Ridder for $4.5 billion. The new owner has already announced plans to sell off 12 Knight Ridder newspapers, including the Philadelphia Inquirer and San Jose Mercury News. Steve Rendell of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting said, quote, The loss of a media outlet is bad for journalism and for democracy because it decreases the number of voices in the debate. Rendell went on to say, quote, this is especially clear in the case of Knight Ridder, whose Washington bureau was one of the only mainstream journalism outfits to consistently challenge the government in the run-up to war in Iraq. Meanwhile, a new report by the Project for Excellence in Journalism is warning there has been a seismic transformation in the media landscape as media companies slash the amount of resources put into original reporting. The study said, quote, the new paradox of journalism is more outlets covering fewer stories. The report notes that in Philadelphia, the number of newspaper reporters has fallen from 500 to 220 in the last quarter century. 5 a.m. radio stations used to cover news in Philadelphia. Now there are two. Nationwide, it's estimated there are 3,500 fewer professional newsroom jobs since 2000, a drop of 7%. Just last week, Washington Post said it would cut 80 newsroom jobs. In Israel, a historian has revealed that Israeli ministers were secretly warned just after the Six-Day War in 1967 that any policy of building settlements across the occupied Palestinian territories violated international law. The foreign ministry's then legal counsel, Theodor Meron, issued a top-secret memo concluding the construction of settlements would, quote, contravene the explicit provisions of the Fourth Geneva Convention. Meron would later become the president of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. The memo is revealed in a new book by Israeli historian Gershon Gerenborg called The Accidental Empire, Israel and the Birth of Settlements. The Observer newspaper of London's reporting the man accused of being an architect of the genocide in Darfur, Major General Salah Abdullah Ghosh, secretly visited London last week to meet senior British officials. Ghosh has been accused of having recruited the Janjaweed Arab militias, responsible for most of the abuses in Darfur. The British Foreign Office initially claimed it had issued a visa to Ghosh so he could undergo medical treatment, but then admitted he'd also met unnamed British officials for, quote, discussions on the Darfur peace process. Human rights groups are up in arms. In Miami, striking janitors at the University of Miami plan to expand their strike to Miami International Airport today after plans for a meeting between the groups involved in the labor dispute broke down. The janitors at both the school and airport are employed by Unico Service Company. And at Pace University in New York, students rallied on Monday to call on the school's administration not to expel two activists for their anti-war activism. The two students, Brian Kelly and Lauren Giacone, say the university is threatening to expel them for distributing flyers and for protesting without a permit. The charges were filed after the two students called Bill Clinton a war criminal during a speech at the school last week. Lauren Giacone spoke on Monday outside Pace University.
They're telling us that we can face any charge from a verbal warning to expulsion. Over this past week, Pace has been leaning more and more towards expulsion. They've been following us around campus, coming to our meetings to harass us, monitoring our websites, and basically telling people that we know that President Caputo is very angry with us and wants to take the fullest extent possible to us, the fullest punishment available.
That was Pace University student Lauren Giacone. And this is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Associated Press has sued the Pentagon for the release of records identifying all past and current detainees at Guantanamo Bay. The AP's suit was filed after the Pentagon failed to respond to a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit filed by AP in January. Last month, the military was ordered to turn over uncensored copies of transcripts from hearings of detainees held at Guantanamo. The transcripts were released, however, they were censored, and names and other key details were blacked out. As international calls grow for the closure of the U.S.-run prison camp at Guantanamo, we bring you a voice rarely heard in this country, in the U.S. media, and that's a former Guantanamo prisoner. In a Democracy Now! National Broadcast exclusive, today we hear Mozambique in his own words. A British citizen born and raised in Birmingham, England, Moza moved to Afghanistan in mid-2001 with his wife and three young children to work as an aid worker in education and water projects. After September 11th and the subsequent U.S. bombing of Afghanistan, he relocated to Pakistan. In February 2002, Mozam was seized by the CIA in Islamabad. No reasons were given for his arrest. He was hooded, shackled, and cuffed, and flown to the U.S. detention facility at Kandahar, then to Bagram Air Base, where he was held for approximately a year before being transferred to Guantanamo Bay. The U.S. government labeled him a, quote, enemy combatant. He was never charged with a crime. In all, Mozam spent 3 years in prison, most of it in solitary confinement. He was subjected to over 300 interrogations as well as death threats and torture. At Bagram, he witnessed the killing of two fellow detainees. In January 2005, he was finally released from Guantanamo. Also, three other British citizens were. He received no apology, no compensation for his incarceration. Mozambeg has written a book about his experience that's just been published in Britain. It's called Enemy Combatant, A British Muslim's Journey to Guantanamo and Back. It's the first book known to be published by a former Guantanamo Bay prisoner. The book is co-written with Victoria Britton, a former associate foreign editor at The Guardian newspaper in London. Well, last week, Victoria Britton and Mozambeg held a public conversation at the Institute of Contemporary Arts in central London. Democracy Now! Was there to cover the story. In this national broadcast exclusive, we bring you Mozam's first comments to air in this country since he wrote his book. After he and Victoria Britton spoke, I had a chance to ask Mozam about the abuse he suffered while he was in prison. Mozam, though you are almost synonymous with Guantanamo when people think about Guantanamo. In your book, you describe being tortured at Bagram. And I was wondering if you could talk about what happened to you there, who tortured and interrogated you, and if you saw other people or knew of other people at Bagram who were killed or abused.
Yeah. I think it's important also to note that when we're talking about Guantanamo Bay, in a sense, or in fact, it's not as bad as Bagram at all. People know about Guantanamo Bay because it's in the news every day. You hear about it. You think it's this terrible place, and it is, because of the absence of the law. But what's worse than Guantanamo Bay are places like these black holes of detention where you don't know what's going on, where there is no access to the media, where the media doesn't know what's going on, and neither does anybody else, including the relatives and so forth. There is no communication. And it is a place it's a military base, but the CIA has complete and utter control of what takes place there. And no wonder in places like Bagram, people are killed. And no wonder in Guantanamo Bay, we haven't heard of any deaths yet. Because in places like Bagram, they can try and justify themselves by the proximity, as they call it, towards the war zone. When I was held in Bagram, it was probably one of the hardest periods of the whole of the incarceration. One particular month in May, I was subjected to some extremely harsh interrogation techniques, which included having my hands tied behind my back to my legs, like an animal, as they call in America, hog-tied, with a hood placed over my head, so I was in a suffocating position, kicked and beaten and sworn at and spat at, left to rot in this position for hours and hours on end, and taken again into interrogation. And this lasted over a period over a month. That wasn't the worst of it, of course. The worst of it, for me, was the psychological part, because all of this time, I had no communication with my family at all. I didn't know what happened to my wife or my children. For all I knew, you know, they could have done terrible things to them. And that was the biggest fear. And I met the International Committee of the Red Cross, and they allowed me to write letters. But of course, all of these letters had to be passed through the US military censorship. And they must have read all of the letters. And in them, I expressed my deep anguish about the state of asking where my wife was from my parents. In one of the interrogations, I remember quite clearly, they had this. I heard the sounds of a woman screaming. And at the back of my mind, I thought, no, it can't be what I truly think it is. And as the screaming got worse and worse, and the shouting to this woman got worse, my heart rate went up. And I started imagining the unimaginable. And certainly they were playing on this. It was, I believe, to this day, probably written on my file, if you want to get to this guy, do it through his family. And so that was definitely one of the hardest parts. Many detainees, in fact, afterwards, when I was removed from that isolation unit, said that, you know, we were praying to God that it's not your wife. You know, thankfully, it wasn't. But and the worst situation I think that I saw there was the deaths of the detainees. I mean, you can see, you can deal with your own abuse to some degree. What you can't do is to see somebody else's and then sit by and let it happen. And yet I was in such a impotent position that I saw a person who'd been chained with his hand above his head like this, which is what they'd often do, what often happened to me if I was just talking to the person next door to me, which was deemed punishable. This person was left suspended like this for hours, and eventually guards came in, they beat him, dragged him upstairs, and we never saw or heard of him again. A year and a half later, internal investigators from the military came and asked me if I would look at a picture. They showed me a picture, and it was a man's body. And they said that he'd been killed. Could I describe any of the details that I'd saw in Bagram at that time? And I described to them what I saw. And then they brought photographs of the people that they said were could be responsible from the military units, the MPs. And I pointed out the people who I believed had done it. And then ironically, this was a time when I was in solitary confinement, also worried about facing a possible military commission by President Bush's order. They said, would you be ready to stand up as a witness in a trial against these perpetrators? That was so ironic.
Who did it to you?
Oh, the interrogators at the time? It was a whole group of them. There was CIA, FBI, and military intelligence. Those were at least the three groups that were there during that interrogation.
Mozam, you talked about one of the men who was killed at Bagram. And you described the guard at Guantanamo who talked about killing another. How did he kill that person?
What had happened, I think the detainee's number was 284, as I recall. This was said to be an escape attempt. At the backs of the cells in Guantanamo, in Bagram, they were all common. There was about seven or eight people in each cell. At the back of the cell was this barrel that they'd cut in half, which was, you know, the toilet. And that was surrounded by some barbed wire. He apparently had pushed the barbed wire through, pushed the barrel, and tried to escape. The guards caught him, jumped on him, and in essence threw Thai boxing-style strikes at him, as this guy told me. And I saw them dragging his body across the cell where I was held in cell 6 into the medical room right in front where we were. At that point, I wasn't sure whether he was dead, but he looked completely battered and bruised, and all the dust that was on him. A while after that, after all the medics and the officers were running around this area, his body was carried out on a stretcher with the sheet covering his head.
And the sexual abuse at Guantanamo and at Bagram?
I don't think you need to go into those.
I would rather just not answer that.
I think
we'll
leave that.
Mozam Beg speaking last week in London at the Institute of Contemporary Art just after the British release of his book, Enemy Combatant. It's coming to this country in the fall. These are his first national broadcast comments in this country, imprisoned at Bagram Air Base and then Guantanamo for over 3 years. When we come back, we talk to his co-writer of the book, Victoria Britton, the former associate editor of The Guardian, and we will also speak with his attorney, Gareth Pierce. Stay with us.
Yo pregunto si en la tierra nunca habrá pensado usted que si las manos son nuestras, es nuestro lo que nos dé.
A desalambrar, a desalambrar, que la tierra es nuestra, es tuya y de aquel, de Pedro y María, de Juan y José.
Si molesto con mi canto alguien que no quiera oír, le aseguro que es un gringo o un dueño de este país. A desalambrar, a desalambrar.
Victor Jara, Tear Down the Fences, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue to look at the case of the former Guantanamo detainee, Mozan Beg, imprisoned for almost 3 years. We're in London last week where we attended a public conversation between Mozan Beg and Victoria Britton, former associate editor at foreign editor at The Guardian newspaper. They were at the Institute of Contemporary Art after the event ended. I had the chance to talk to Victoria Britton, former associate editor at The Guardian, has worked on issues around Guantanamo for years. She co-wrote the play Guantanamo, Honor Bound to Defend Freedom, and along with Mozan Beg, helped write Enemy Combatant, A British Muslim's Journey to Guantanamo and Back.
So the book is out that you helped Mozan write. He is out of Guantanamo. You've been an advocate for Mozan and other Guantanamo detainees for years now, spending a great deal of time with their families. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think it's fantastic that the book is out and it's the same week as the film is out, because these boys' stories are told by them. But the sadness of the families whose people aren't out just gets more and more painful and more difficult to work on. And although the tide is changing, it's not changing fast enough. I see these kids growing up who've been without their dads for 4 years. I see these women who've been without husbands for 4 years and mothers without their sons for 4 years. It's agony. It's just unbearable.
Can you tell us about one of the people who's still in Guantanamo?
Well, just to give you one example, there's Fawzi Alauda, who's a Kuwaiti, whose story has been told very many times, very well in America, who has the best Washington lawyer, Tom Wilmer. And he is totally and completely innocent. And I am faced, as I was this week, with a State Department official showing me on radio the tube that Fawzi is being force-fed with up his nose and telling me it's not so bad. And when I say he's innocent, and you know he's innocent, his case is so well documented, she just says, I can't deal with these separate cases. And the dehumanization that I see from those kind of American officials compared with the incredible humanity of the American lawyers that I've learned to work with just makes me so sad and angry.
Who was the State Department official?
I'm afraid I don't remember.
Alberto Gonzalez is here this week.
Yes, but no, this was a woman. She was called Colleen somebody.
Mm-hmm. And what about Alberto Gonzalez's trip? What was its point?
I think it was a propaganda offensive in which they brought all these people and they've been on all sorts of venues trying to change public opinion in Britain to be as it is in America, and think maybe it's all right. But they've lost it here. Everybody knows that Guantanamo is an outrage.
Victoria Britton, who co-wrote Mozan Beg's book, Enemy Combatant, A British Muslim's Journey to Guantanamo and Back. Also at the event was British attorney Gareth Pearce. She slipped in as Mozan was speaking. She's represented Mozan Beg as well as three other British citizens released from Guantanamo, known as the Tipton Three. Gareth Pearce is one of the leading human rights lawyers in Britain. She represented the Birmingham Six and the Guildford Four. Actress Emma Thompson played her character in the movie In the Name of the Father. I asked Gareth Pearce about recent comments made by British Prime Minister Tony Blair calling Guantanamo Bay a, quote, anomaly.
Well, it's a bit rich for him to be using weasel words like that when our government has been utterly complicit sending people to conduct interrogations there. We have as much blood on our hands as the Americans.
Alberto Gonzalez, the Attorney General of the United States, is here this week?
Yes.
What is
yes.
he doing?
He seems to be advertising Guantanamo as a good thing. He seems to be suggesting that torture as defined by him doesn't constitute torture. He's shamelessly promulgating his line, and his line is not, in my view, a lawful line.
Leading British human rights lawyer Gareth Pearce, one of Mozambique's attorneys. She came to hear her client, Mozam, tell the story of his almost 3-year imprisonment by the U.S. As Mozam came to leave the event, I asked him if he would be coming to the United States to promote the U.S. publication of his book, Enemy Combatant.
Will you be coming to the United States, a simple?
Probably not, no, probably not.
Probably not, Mozam said. Well, we're joined in the studio now by Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, that's represented Mozambique as well as hundreds of other detainees at Guantanamo. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you for having me, Amy.
What Mozam said, what he experienced himself at Bagram, the torture, seeing others killed, can you talk about it?
You know, we focused on Guantanamo for a long time. Always understanding that that's where we could get access to after we won in the Supreme Court, et cetera. But in the end, we recognized that what the U.S. was doing at prisons other than Guantanamo, Bagram, other CIA dark places, was probably much worse than what we've seen in Guantanamo. And, of course, in that compelling interview with Mozam, he really affirms what we have seen some details of over the last couple of years. We actually knew of the case, I think, that he's addressing in December 2002 about two people being hung from the ceiling, and only as things have been revealed has there been even any investigation of that. But the key thing, I think, that came out of Mozam's testimony is what happened at Bagram was routine. Hanging people from the ceiling, depriving them of sleep, and beating them was absolutely routine at Bagram. And yet, today as we sit here, little or nothing has been done about it. In two of the murders that we know about, 27 people were implicated. Only a few of those were ever tried. The longest person did 5 months. And at none of those trials did evidence come in that should have about how this went up the chain of command and not simply down to the lowest guys who actually were involved in the alleged murders.
People are trying to get information about Guantanamo. We just read the piece about Associated Press trying to get information. Then there's the news from Guantanamo that human rights lawyers are asking the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights to suspend the military tribunal of a Canadian citizen who's been held at the base since he was 15. Lawyers said Omar Khadr is the first person in modern world history to face a military commission for alleged crimes committed as a child.
Well, it's remarkable. I mean, we've been going to the Inter-American Commission. They've been issuing orders against the United States for 4 years now since Guantanamo has been set up. The United States insists that it can use military commissions, that it can use them even if it's in regular combat situations. That case is going to be argued, not Khadr's, but a similar case in the Supreme Court very soon. Guantanamo still represents, I think, in this world and in the Muslim world, something that is completely outside the law, that is iconic, really, in the world for everything the United States is doing wrong in the war on terror. And we're still not getting the full information. We're still litigating all the time against the government to get this.
You're calling for the impeachment of President Bush?
That's correct. We've written a book called Articles of Impeachment against George W. Bush, and it lays out 4 articles of impeachment against Bush.
Can you explain how that compares to what Senator Russell Feingold has done? And we're going to play this in a minute. And that is calling for the censure of President Bush, also an extremely rare move.
Well, censure is a very rare move. It's a much less drastic remedy than impeachment. It simply is the Senate saying, as Feingold's resolution says, we hereby censure George W. Bush for using illegal electronic surveillance. It doesn't have any consequences other than condemning the president on that basis. And so it's a much lesser form. And at the center, while we support or think that it's important that they go forward with that, that's really not sufficient. Our view is that won't stop illegal warrantless wiretapping, which is going on as we speak, and will leave the president in office to continue doing what he's doing, whether it's at Guantanamo or in Iraq or with warrantless wiretapping. What is amazing about, though, I think the impeach the censure resolution by Feingold, which is, as I said, just saying you're a bad guy, President, or on this one issue of wiretapping, is that even on that issue, he's not getting the support he should. Even the Democrats are fleeing from the statement that the president unauthorized or illegally is electronically surveilling Americans. That's remarkable to me. It's open and shut case. Legal sand is being thrown in our face by the administration, but there's no issue. The president broke the law. It's a criminal law. He broke it. How can people even run from a censure resolution? It's only happened, censure resolutions have only occurred a couple of times in our history. One actually passed in the 1830s. They attempted it against Clinton. It didn't happen. But at the center, we don't believe that's sufficient. But even that, as I said, Democrats are running from.
Well, we're going to go right now to the issue of President Bush's domestic spying program and the issue of censure. On Monday, Democratic Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin introduced a resolution to censure President Bush for authorizing the no-warrant domestic surveillance program. Feingold accused Bush of breaking the law and misleading Congress about it. As Feingold spoke, Democratic leaders held off the immediate vote that Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist requested. The Bush administration had argued Congress granted President Bush the power to order U.S. intelligence agencies to conduct domestic surveillance with a resolution authorizing military action after the September 11, 2001 attacks. The Bush administration also says the president has the authority as commander-in-chief of the military. Before Feingold took the floor Monday, Majority Leader Bill Frist spoke.
Just to clarify, he has said his intentions, representing the other side of the aisle, is to offer a resolution to censure the president of the United States of America for a program which I have said, and I will restate, is a lawful program, is a program that is constitutional, and is a program that is vital to the safety and security of the American people.
Majority Leader Bill Frist addressing the Senate Monday. Soon after, Wisconsin Democrats Russ Feingold introduced his resolution to censure President Bush.
When the President of the United States breaks the law, he must be held accountable. That is why today I'm introducing a resolution to censure President George W. Bush. The president authorized an illegal program to spy on American citizens on American soil and then misled the Congress and the public about the existence and the legality of that program. It is up to this body to reaffirm the rule of law by condemning the president's actions. All of us in this body took an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States and bear true allegiance to the same. Fulfilling that oath requires us to speak clearly and forcefully when the president violates the law. This resolution allows us to send a clear message that the president's conduct was wrong. And we must do that. The president's actions demand a formal judgment from Congress. At moments in our history like this, we are reminded why the founders balanced the powers of the different branches of government so carefully in the Constitution. At the very heart of our system of government lies the recognition that some leaders will do wrong and that others in the government will then bear the responsibility to do right. This president has done wrong. This body can do right by condemning his conduct and showing the people of this nation that his actions will not be allowed to stand unchallenged. To date, members of Congress have responded in very different ways to the president's conduct. Some are responding by defending his conduct, ceding him the power he claims, and even seeking to grant him expanded statutory authorization powers to make his conduct legal. While we know he is breaking the law, we do not know all the details of what the president has authorized, or whether there is any need to change the law to allow it, yet some want to give him carte blanche to continue his illegal conduct. To approve the president's actions now, without demanding a full inquiry into this program, a detailed explanation for why the president authorized it, and accountability for his illegal actions, would be irresponsible. It would be to abandon the duty of the legislative branch under our constitutional system of separation of powers, while the president recklessly grabs for power and ignores the rule of law. Others in Congress have taken important steps to check the president. Senator Spector has held hearings on the wiretapping program in the Judiciary Committee. He has even suggested that Congress may need to use the power of the purse in order to get some answers out of the administration. And Senator Byrd has proposed that Congress establish an independent commission to investigate this program. As we move forward, Congress will need to consider a range of possible actions, including investigations, independent commissions, legislation, or even impeachment. But at a minimum, Congress should censure a president who has so plainly broken the law. Now, Mr. President, our founders anticipated that these kinds of abuses would occur. Federalist number 51 speaks of the Constitution's system of checks and balances. It says it may be a reflection on human nature that such devices should be necessary to control the abuses of government. But what is government itself but the greatest of all reflections of human nature? If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself. Mr. President, we are faced with an executive branch that places itself above the law. The founders understood that the branches must check each other to control abuses of government power. The president's actions are such an abuse. His actions must be checked, and he should be censured. This president exploited the climate of anxiety after September 11, 2001, both to push for overly intrusive powers in the Patriot Act and to take us into a war in Iraq that has been a tragic diversion from the critical fight against Al-Qaeda and its affiliates. In both of these instances, however, Congress gave its approval to the president's actions, however mistaken the approval may have been. Now, here's the difference, Mr. President. This was not the case with the illegal domestic wiretapping program authorized by the president shortly after September 11. The president violated the law, ignored the Constitution and the other two branches of government, and disregarded the rights and freedoms upon which our country was founded. No one questions, Mr. President, no one questions whether the government should wiretap suspected terrorists. Of course we should, and we can under current law. If there were a demonstrated need to change the law, of course Congress should consider that step. But instead, the president is refusing to follow the law while offering the flimsiest of arguments to justify his misconduct. Mr. President, he must be held accountable for his actions. Now, the facts are pretty straightforward. Congress passed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, known as FISA, nearly 30 years ago to ensure that as we wiretap suspected terrorists and spies, we also protect innocent Americans from unjustified government intrusion. Mr. President, FISA makes it a crime to wiretap Americans on U.S. soil without the requisite warrants, and the president has ordered warrantless wiretaps of Americans on U.S. soil, so it's pretty simple. The president has broken that law, and that alone is unacceptable. But the president did much more than that. Not only did the president break the law, he also actively misled Congress and the American people about his actions. And then, when the program was made public about the legality of the NSA program, he has fundamentally violated the trust of the American people. The president's own words show just how seriously he has violated that trust. We now know that the NSA wiretapping program began not long after September 11. Before the existence of this program was revealed, the president went out of his way. He went out of his way, Mr. President, in several speeches to assure the public that the government was getting court orders to wiretap Americans in the United States, something he now admits was not the case. On April 20, 2004, for example, the president told an audience in Buffalo that, quote, anytime you hear the United States government talking about wiretaps, it requires a wiretap, requires a court order. Nothing has changed, by the way, unquote. In fact, a lot had changed. But the president wasn't up front with the American people. Just months later, on July 14, 2004, in my own state of Wisconsin, the president said that, quote, any action that takes place by law enforcement requires a court order. In other words, The government can't move on wiretaps or roving wiretaps without getting a court order, unquote. And then, Mr. President, last summer, on June 9, 2005, the president spoke in Columbus, Ohio, and again insisted that his administration was abiding by the laws governing wiretaps. Quote, law enforcement officers need a federal judge's permission to wiretap a foreign terrorist's phone, a federal judge's permission to track his calls, or a federal judge's permission to search his property. Officers must meet strict standards to use any of these tools, and these standards are fully consistent with the Constitution of the United States, unquote. Now, Mr. President, in all of these cases, the president knew that he wasn't telling the complete story. But engaged in tough political battle during the presidential campaign and later over the Patriot Act reauthorization, he wanted to convince the public that a system of checks and balances was in place to protect the innocent people from government snooping. He knew when he gave those reassurances that he had authorized the NSA to bypass the very system of checks and balances that he was using as a shield against criticism of the Patriot Act and his administration's performance. Mr. President, this conduct is unacceptable. The president has a duty to play it straight with the American people. But for political purposes, he just ignored that duty.
Democratic Senator Russell Feingold introducing a resolution of censure of President Bush. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Solo voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena. Correré mi destino para burlar la ley. Perdido en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me dicen el clandestino por no llevar papel. Pa' una ciudad del norte yo me fui a trabajar. Mi vida la dejé entre Ceuta y Gibraltar. Soy una raya en el mar, fantasma en la ciudad. Mi vida va prohibida, dice la autoridad. Solo
Manu Chao here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. In a minute, we go to what may have been the biggest protest ever in Chicago. It happened this past Friday. It got almost no attention. But first, back to the Senate floor. After Senator Feingold introduced his resolution to censure President Bush, he immediately left the chambers. Republican Senator Arlen Specter blasted Feingold for leaving and called the resolution to censure excessive, explaining that, quote, the president may be wrong, but he has not acted in bad faith. Following Specter's complaint that he'd wanted to debate Feingold, Democratic Senator Dick Durbin from Illinois took to the floor to fill in for Feingold and debate Specter.
After listening to Attorney General Gonzalez's testimony before our committee, it appears that the thrust of the constitutional argument justifying the wiretap goes back to a vote that we share, a vote we both cast in favor of authorizing the use of military force on September 18, 2001. I would like to ask the senator from Pennsylvania if he believed that in casting his vote for that resolution authorizing force to pursue those responsible for 9/11, that he was giving the president authority to wiretap American citizens without obtaining a court order required by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978.
No.
The next question I would like to ask the senator from Pennsylvania, and I appreciate his forthright response. The majority leader, Senator Frist, came to the floor a few moments ago and said he believed the wiretap program of President Bush was both constitutional and legal. Does the senator from Pennsylvania agree with that conclusion?
I neither agree nor disagree. I don't know. And as I said more extensively in the body of my comments, I don't have any basis for knowing because I don't know what the program does. And I think that it may be that the program could be structured going after only Al-Qaeda conversations, and I'd like to see some proof on that, quite frankly, that they have reasonable grounds to think that one party or the other is Al-Qaeda. That's in the body of Senator Feingold's whereas clauses. And it may be that they have been able to take a limited amount of information and destroy the rest, and that it's produced very important results, and that there has been a minimal incursion. I don't know the answers to those questions, but I certainly think that you oughtn't to castigate the president as a criminal until you do know the answers to those questions.
If the Senate
Republican Senator Allen Specter of Pennsylvania speaking in the Senate chambers after Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold introduced a proposal to censure President Bush. He was speaking with Illinois Senator Dick Durbin. And that's where we're going to go right now, to Illinois, to Chicago. It was massive. It happened last Friday, perhaps the biggest march in Chicago history. It's around the political debate over immigration reform that's continuing to heat up around the country following the recent passage of a bill by the House of Representatives. Numbers were between 100,000, 200,000, 300,000 marchers taking to the streets of Chicago on Friday to fight the bill that would drastically strengthen immigration enforcement, including extending a fence along the Mexican border and severe punishment for those who aid undocumented immigrants. The mostly Latino marchers crammed the streets carrying signs saying, for example, no human being is illegal and we're not criminals. Critics say the so-called Sensenbrenner bill would turn millions of immigrants into felons for crossing the border without permission. Police estimated around 100,000 people marched. We are going to turn right now to one of those who organized the march. The organizers estimated the numbers were as many as 500,000 people, and newspaper reports ranged in their estimates. Last Tuesday, thousands of immigrants rallied outside the U.S. Capitol. More action is expected to come across the country as the bills debated in Congress. Marchers in Chicago had the support of local politicians. Democratic Congressmember Luis Gutierrez said in a speech, "This is our country, and this is where we'll stay." The Democratic governor addressed the crowd in Spanish, saying, "You're not criminals, you're workers." Longtime Mayor Richard Daley also pledged support. We're joined now in Chicago studio by Abel Nunez, associate director of one of the many groups that spearheaded the event. Centro Romero is a community-based organization that serves the refugee immigrant population in the northeast side of Chicago. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Abel Nunez.
Yeah. Good morning.
This has gotten almost no attention in this country. Massive protest. Did you expect the numbers of people who protested on Friday?
Actually, yes. I think the organizers were the only ones that really believed the turnout was going to be that big. I think the rest of, you know, we're very much a silent, invisible, marginalized community. But I think the organizers had a feeling that it was going to be a huge march.
Can you talk about exactly why people took to the streets?
Yeah, I think that there is a feeling that, you know, there are laws coming that are putting people between a rock and a hard place, and they have no place to go. Unfortunately, they have nothing to lose. A lot of people that are undocumented feel fear about coming out and in past, that's why they haven't really demonstrated. But now, They feel like they have nothing to lose, that for the first time this country is telling them you're not wanted. I mean, it's not about just not being able to adjust your status. It's now about we want you out.
Talk about where the legislation is right now. Passed by the House but not by the Senate?
Correct. Actually, right now, the Senate Judiciary Committee is discussing their version of it. It is the time when I think the leadership of the Senate wants a vote on a specific bill by the 27th of this month. So grassroots movements are mobilizing to ensure that the Senate hears, not only sees the show of marchers on the street, but also you know, they hear from voters that this is not the America that we want. And I think that as, you know, during this time, we're trying to mobilize again people to send in letters, call into the Senate. It appears that if something happens, it will be somewhat different than the House bill that was approved, the Sensenbrenner H.R. 4437.
We're talking to Abel Nunez, who's with Centro Romero, a community-based group in Chicago, one of the organizers of the mass protest on Friday there. Last week in our headlines, we read that the Senate Judiciary Committee is considering a law that would classify social workers who feed and house undocumented workers as human traffickers. The ACLU criticizing the bill, saying it gives extraordinary powers to detain non-citizens indefinitely without meaningful review. It'll potentially place many non-citizens in a legal black hole that subjects them to a life sentence after having served a criminal sentence, or in some cases without ever having been convicted of a crime. Can you just go through the legislation and what is being considered now?
Correct. The House Bill 4437 served as a launching point for the Senate. Senator Spector basically introduced his version of the bill to be discussed on the Senate subcommittee, and it took a lot of the border enforcement. The only difference with his bill is that he did add what for the Republican Party is a controversial guest worker program without the possibility of ever of citizenship or a path to citizenship. So, and at this moment they're being discussed, and Senator Durbin is part of that committee. Our senator here in Illinois has been a champion of the immigrant fight, and the different forces are trying to ensure that if any bill passes the Senate, it's more of a balanced effect instead of and not only an enforcement bill.
Can you talk about the wall?
Yes, on the H.R. 4437, one of the provisions is that a wall be constructed on the southern border between Mexico and the United States. And this is somehow, according to the bill, would prevent immigrants from coming. I think that misses the point, and it doesn't really address the real issues as to why people are coming to this country. And I think that the facts show that this country needs the immigrant labor force. The globalization factors, some factors that, you know, we as an immigrant community have no control over, are pushing the demand for this labor. So I think that the wall is an attempt to kind of put a facade of security, given, you know, our current environment of terrorism and protectionism that we're living in this country. But in reality, it will do nothing to stem the flow of immigration, and it does nothing for the more than 11 million undocumented immigrants that are here in this country working.
Where does due process fit into this picture?
Well, I think that's what they're taking out. I think, you know, their mode of thinking is that, you know, they need to expedite. They need to give powers to law enforcement to expedite removal of this country. And one of the laws that have been put in place actually have taken a lot of due process and made it much more easier for, you know, border agents and immigration officials to deport immigrants immediately without giving them the due process. I think that really goes against the tradition of this country about giving people an opportunity to expose their case.
Abel Nunez, what are you proposing as an alternative immigration plan?
Yeah, I think if we're really discussing about true immigration reform, one, it has to address the 11 million undocumented immigrants living and working in the United States. We need to find a way to legalize their status. Two, we need to create a program by which we address the flow of immigrants that will continue to come to this country in a way that's safe, in a way to regulate their passage. And third, I think that we need to look at also the waiting lines that exist for family members to petition other family members. I mean, people here, citizens, are petitioning family members, and it's taking, in some cases, 12 years before, you know, a visa is available to them. I think that the system is broken. It doesn't truly address the current needs of this country. And if we're talking about immigration reform, we really have to address, we have to approach it from, you know, from a holistic approach instead of just enforcement. We need to...
Abel Nunez, on that note, I want to thank you very much for joining us. He is with the Centro Romero community-based group in Chicago, and we'll certainly continue to cover this issue. That does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, who will produce Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, Ruba Rich, and Aaron Mate, Maddie Harper, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.